Have a little bit of time. Yeah, I've got a few words. I'll get this over. It shouldn't take very long. It's only a few pages. But, yeah. Well, let me begin by firstly thanking you all for coming along here on this freezing cold morning. I really appreciate it. The only good thing I can say to you is at least it's not snowing. It is due to snow here tonight about 6 o'clock, so hopefully you'll all be warm and home by then. I want to start by just reading out some messages of support that I've heard over the last couple of weeks since the start of the campaign. Some messages of support for the idea of curbing bankers' bonuses. This first one: we cannot allow ourselves to be held hostage by institutions that are too big to fail. That was Mervyn King, the governor of Bank of England, speaking to the Times last week. Here's another good one. Bank profits from 2009 are a gift from government. Therefore, paying bonuses on these profits is wrong. That's George Soros. George Soros told that to the BBC. And Stephen Green, the chairman of HSBC and the chairman of the British Bankers Association, told the Financial Times that in the market of bankers' remuneration, there's been plenty of distortion, giving rise to wrong and, frankly, inflated bonus payments. The BBC's Robert Peston reported that Stephen Green was also present at a private meeting of senior bankers, hedge fund magnates and such like in Davos this weekend. According to Peston, they gathered together in secret, and as part of their discussions they took a vote on what was likely to happen on the issue of bank bonuses in the coming years. They imagined that there would be three scenarios. Firstly, the first scenario was that bankers would refuse to change their ways, all the fuss about bonuses will die down and it's back to business as usual for the super rich. That was option one. Option two was that the bankers take steps to reform their bonus culture, and this placates politicians and public alike. And the third option was that bankers do absolutely nothing and politicians force draconian changes to banking remuneration. So they put down their whiskies and their cigars and had a little vote, and it was a dead tie between options two and three. The first option: bankers refuse to change their ways, the fuss dies down, it's back to business as usual, garnered very, very few votes. Very few votes. And I think that's significant that even the bankers realise that their bonuses are indeed in trouble. So if the bankers themselves are so aware that the game is up, what are we doing here on a cold day? Well, the reason we're here at Speaker's Corner is because this place has a great tradition of being somewhere where dissent can be freely expressed. It's a place where citizens can peacefully assemble. It's a place where the Chartists, where the Reform League, where the suffragettes all gathered and held public meetings. And such luminaries as Karl Marx, William Morris, George Orwell, Marcus Garvey and Lord Soper have all climbed the ladder and spoken here in public. So it's a very important place in that sense. Why are we here? Well, I'm here because tonight I will break the habit of a lifetime by refusing to pay my income tax. This is not something that I undertake lightly, and not because I'm afraid of the £100 fine that I will immediately incur. To me, paying my income tax is an expression of social solidarity, a means of making a contribution to the common good. Paying taxes is a way of recognising that in any society, we all of us have some degree of responsibility for one another. Of course, this is not a very fashionable idea these days in a land where celebrity and consumerism have been elevated above all other aspirations for the individual. If you have no sense of responsibility, of course, it's very easy to act like an arsehole. But I'm not saying that I love paying my taxes, or that I don't often wish that my bills were lower. But what I do see in my line of work is that when I have a good year, when I have an album out and do lots of gigs, my taxes are high. When I'm not so busy, maybe when I'm writing songs or just doing a few taxes, my bill is low. I recognise that the tax regime is fair in the way that it's collected. And when I pay up, I expect that the manner in which my income is redistributed will also be fair, in the sense that those who have the greatest need should receive the greatest support. Paying my income tax on time is my way of showing that I am a responsible citizen, that I am not above society, but part of it. So what has brought me to contemplate this irresponsible act of withholding my taxes tonight? A couple of weeks ago, while watching the 10 o'clock news, I saw a report about Stephen Hester, chief executive of the Royal Bank of Scotland, 84% of which is owned by us, the taxpayer. He was giving evidence to the Treasury Select Committee of the House of Commons. Our elected representatives asked Mr. Hester how he could justify paying an estimated $1.5 billion in bonuses to his staff when the bank had been so recently bailed out by public funds. He replied that there was nothing he could do about it because he was a prisoner of the market. When asked if he had a strategy for explaining this huge bonus payout to the taxpayer, coming just a year after the RBS registered the largest corporate losses in British commercial history, he smirked and said that he was thinking of going on a long holiday. We had come to expect such callous comments from the city, but this really shocked me. Our taxes saved his company, and for the foreseeable future, we will be underwriting his business. Did this man have no sense of responsibility towards his shareholders? Us, the British people? Because that's what we are. We are all shareholders in the Royal Bank of Scotland. How did this come about? It came about because in October 2008, faced by the biggest financial crisis since the Great Depression, Gordon Brown bailed out the banks in order, he said, and I'm quoting here, to deal with the impact and root causes of the current financial instability, the excessive and sometimes undisclosed risk-taking by financial institutions that did not have adequate capital or proper transparency. Speaking from Downing Street on that fateful day, Brown attacked bonus culture for providing incentives for irresponsibility and excessive risk-taking for which the rest of us are forced to pay. Now I understand, I accept that the Treasury had little choice but to use taxpayers' money to safeguard our savings and stabilise and restore confidence in the financial system. I accept that. I also understand how we will benefit when and if RBS becomes solvent again. What I don't understand is why the chief executive of our bank thinks that the best way to resolve the company's fortunes, restore the company's fortunes, is to indulge in the kind of irresponsible behaviour that got us into this mess in the first place by paying excessive bonuses at the first possible opportunity. My sense of outrage was compounded by the fact that for the past few months, politicians of all the main parties have been falling over themselves to prepare us for painful cuts in public services. Whoever wins the next election, we have no choice. The national debt must be brought down, they tell us, whatever the consequences. Yet the fact that this debt is a direct result of the banking crisis never seems to get mentioned. The bankers' obstinate insensitivity to public opinion has been clear in the arrogant comments that have been made by them and their supporters on our website in the past couple of weeks. In their arguments in favour of paying these excessive bonuses, the only rationale they have is that of the free market. As far as they're concerned, there are absolutely no other considerations. Stephen Hester told the Commons Select Committee that he had to pay these huge bonuses because he was a prisoner of the market. Held against his will by the invisible hand of Adam Smith, the unseen force which it is claimed makes capitalism self-regulating. Hester speaks of these rules of the market, as if they are somehow immutable, like Newton's laws of physics, that they apply everywhere, to everyone, can never be broken, never even questioned. Someone should explain to Mr. Hester that when the government bailed out RBS, they broke the biggest rule of the market. That is, that when a business fails, it should cease to exist. Isn't that how Adam Smith's invisible hand works? But if a business becomes too big to fail, then the rules of the market are suspended. If the invisible hand of the market has to be replaced by the helping hand of the people in the form of taxpayers' money, then the market system is broken and the entire free enterprise experiment of the last 30 years has failed. The greatest sleight of hand during this period has been the myth of trickle-down economics, a theory propagated by Ronald Reagan, which held that if the rich were allowed to accumulate wealth unfettered by taxes and red tape, then their industriousness would drive the whole economy, creating jobs and services and allowing wealth to trickle down to the rest of the population. Now, this idea was used by Reagan and Thatcher in the early 80s to justify slashing individual and corporate taxes. The rich were no longer required to express their responsibilities to society in terms of making a contribution to collective provision. In fact, all they had to do in order to make life better for everybody else was simply to get richer. This flimsy idea has been used for the past 30 years by successive governments to justify keeping taxes for the rich low. But the fact is, it doesn't work. Figures released last week by the Independent National Equality Panel show that the gap between the rich and poor in this country is now wider than it was 30 years ago. A graph contained in the report shows average male weekly earnings from 1968 to 2008 divided into three groups: the low paid, the middle income, and the richest 10%. Now, for the first decade, those three lines move along the graph more or less in concert with one another. When the wages of the richest 10% lifted a little, then the wages of the middle and the poorer sections also lifted. After 1980 and the introduction of trickle-down economics, the rich begin to pull away. 30 years later, in 2008, the poor are more or less where they were in 1968. The middle group have risen a little, while the richest 10% are now 100 times better off than the poorest 10%. There is, of course, another group that are not shown in this graph, the richest 1%. And their income has risen so fast, so quickly, that they leave even the richest 10% far behind. And what have been the effects of allowing the rich to no longer express their responsibilities in terms of progressive taxation? A startling drop in the collective provision of education, housing, and healthcare that has been damaging to our society. The National Equality Panel report showed that societies that suffer from greater inequality are also plagued by more children dropping out of school, more violent crime, more mental illness than societies in which the gap between the rich and the poor is not so marked. David Cameron is constantly claiming that our society is broken, but he's less keen to admit that it has been torn apart by inequality. His remedy is for us to take more responsibility for one another in the form of voluntary and charitable work. This dogmatic attachment to free market principles blinds him to the fact that we already have a mechanism for expressing our responsibility to one another. The collective provision of free healthcare, free education, and decent, affordable housing by a society which taxes each citizen according to their ability to pay. That is what is broken in Britain, the connect between the aspirations of the individual and those of the community as a whole. Yes, the individual is the most important component in society, but the reckless behaviour of the individual cannot be ignored if that society is to feel at ease with itself. Unless each individual is the recipient of collectively provided support at those crucial junctures in life, in the classroom, in the hospital, when seeking shelter, then only the rich and the powerful will be able to realise their full potential, and the rest of us will be left to rely on their charity. That's why this issue is so important. Brown was right to call those bonuses incentives for irresponsibility. And that is why so many people angered by the sheer lack of any kind of responsibility towards the British taxpayer shown by those RBS bankers who threaten to leave the country if their demands are not met. And that is the only argument that our opponents have. You know, they repeat it so many times that I have to suppose that they have no idea how offensive it sounds. Unless you pay us our excessive bonuses, we will walk away and leave you to clear up the mess that we have created. This is how they respond to our generosity, with threats. Do these people have no shame? Where's their sense of loyalty to those who saved them from ruin? Where is their sense of responsibility to the taxpayer? Well, they say we are being responsible. Let us earn our millions and we will bring more money to the economy. Don't give me that trickle-down bullshit. We've tried letting the rich loose. And not only did their recklessness derail our economy, but it's also ended up with people earning 100 times more than the poorest 10% in our society. Bankers see everything in terms of what they call the quantum, what I might call the wonga, the money. They don't understand that this issue of bonuses is not simply about the money, it's about the morality. Bankers defend their right to excessive bonuses in purely commercial terms. As if they think they're still working at RBS for a private company. But this is not about commercial terms. This is about what kind of society we want to live in. Allowing even 1% of the population to earn such excessive rewards creates a gulf of inequality that affects us all. A society which tolerates such inequalities can never be at ease with itself. Now, I'm standing here today in the cold with you because I just don't see any politician out there willing to take up this cause. Not only to call the bankers bluff on bonuses, but to admit that the market is broken, that the invisible hand of free enterprise, relied upon by Tony Blair and Margaret Thatcher alike to reach into the darkest corners of our society, has not only failed to make us all better off, but now threatens to make paupers of us all. And what are we offered as a remedy for this sorry state of affairs? Cuts in public services, the hardest working people to be hit the hardest. Where is the party leader who is prepared to make a case for greater funding for the helping hand of the people that acts to lift up citizen and banker alike in time of need? When the invisible hand of capitalism failed to lift a finger to help the Royal Bank of Scotland, it was the people's hand that reached out to save them in their moment of crisis. The compassionate hand that holds the newborn baby at birth. The teaching hand that guides the school child in the classroom. The caring hand that helps us when we're old and infirm. The steadfast hand that guards us while we sleep. I am talking about the hand of the people. The helping hand that receives little credit for its work, yet asks no reward, save that each of us make a contribution to its work by paying our taxes. In the coming days, the helping hand is going to be needed by more and more who will be forced to live with the consequences of the bankers' irresponsibility. Their lives will become pressured. Their health will suffer. Their sense of security will be undermined. Millions of workers are already facing stark choices. Are they willing to work longer hours for less money, or would they rather be unemployed? Well, I don't see why the bankers at RBS shouldn't be asked that same question. Yeah. It's not as if our demands are utopian. You know, we're not trying to storm the Winter Palace here. You know, we're not even trying to abolish bonuses altogether. We simply want to exercise our rights as majority shareholders of Royal Bank of Scotland by limiting the bonuses paid to staff. When the Treasury negotiated the bailout, RBS agreed that the Chancellor should have a veto on any bonus payments above £25,000. Presumably, both parties felt this provision to be reasonable or they wouldn't have signed the deal. You know, our weapon against the bonuses is not the pitchfork and the flame. It's part of the contractual agreement between the bank and the government. What is stopping Alistair Darling from using this veto? Maybe he believes the bankers' inflated sense of their own self-worth, that the investment staff at RBS are the only people in the world capable of doing that very difficult job. And if their bonuses are curbed, then they'll fly away and the sky will fall in on us all. Our job in the coming weeks is to convince the Chancellor that there are plenty of bankers out there who are willing to stand shoulder to shoulder with the British people in this time of economic crisis and work for fair remuneration in our nationally owned banks. We have to convince the Chancellor that there are bankers who are prepared to do their bit to rebuild the trust and confidence that are crucial if we are to live in a market economy. Bankers who believe that they have a responsibility to the taxpayer who saved them from ruin. Most importantly, the bankers who realise that to receive excessive bonus payments now, at a time when so many people are suffering as a result of their irresponsible risk taking, would undermine public confidence in their profession. Sadly, we never hear from those bankers. The trustworthy, the dependable, the hard-working bankers. It's always the loud, aggressive, greedy bankers we hear from, demanding more handouts from the state to support their feckless lifestyles. Well, we don't need those bankers anymore. They're the ones who got us into this mess. And their inability to understand their destructive role in the credit crunch is underlined by their eagerness to get back to business as usual. Let them go, I say. For what we lose in terms of economic power, we will gain in social cohesion. Casting out the money changers now would put down a marker in this election year, a clear declaration that the citizens of this country are no longer held in thrall to the mythology of the markets. That we believe the wealth creation is beneficial to our society only if everyone shares in those benefits. We've come out here today to do as citizens what our political leaders seem unable to contemplate. This government has failed to narrow the inequality gap because it has refused to face down the richest 10% in this country. You know, they seek to avoid this issue, to explain this apparent oversight of the government by smugly pointing to the shocking revelation in the National Equality Panel report, which recorded unbelievably a decline in the number of people who wish to see the equality gap narrow. But the thing is, with those figures, those opinions were formed during an economic boom, which has proved to be unsustainable. I would bet good money that those numbers who want to see the inequality gap narrow have dramatically risen as families begin to suffer the aftershocks of the banking crisis. In the coming days, more and more people will be forced to rely on the hard-working people in the public sector to get by. What our society needs is not cuts in public services and tax breaks for the rich. Instead, we need to recognise that we are all in this together and that the only real prospect of digging ourselves out of this hole is to abandon the market-led policies of the last 30 years and commit ourselves once again to a progressive tax regime, the helping hand of the people that shapes a compassionate society where a commonly held sense of fairness ensures that each contributes according to their means while each receives according to their need. The bankers received what they needed in their hour of crisis. Now it's time for them to contribute in accordance with their means. The financiers know this, which is why they huddled together in that secret meeting in Davos. They know that the payment of excessive bonuses is morally unacceptable after the devastating crash of 2008. They're expecting to have to take bad medicine to cure their ailments. And yet our government somehow seem reluctant to administer it. The failure of politicians to act on bankers' bonuses is a relic of the monetarist orthodoxies of the past 30 years, a stark illustration of a value system gone wrong. It begs the question, who really runs this country. And it feeds into a sense of powerlessness that spells danger for democracy in an election year. But I don't believe that we're powerless. The very fact that those bank chairmen gathered together in Davos, skulking in their secret meeting, they know the power that public opinion has. They know that they must change their ways. They're just waiting for a nudge. Well, George Osborne isn't going to give them that nudge, and nor, it seems, is Alistair Darling. Instead, it's left to us, the ordinary taxpayer, the ordinary working people, to apply the pressure. And that's why I'll be withholding my taxes tonight. It seems to me to be the only weapon I have to draw attention to this issue and to put pressure on the one man who can significantly make a difference to this, Alistair Darling, the Chancellor of the Exchequer, in charge of the Treasury, the man who has in his pocket the veto to deal with the RBS bonuses. Now, if we can do that, if we can put that pressure on, I believe we can make this issue of inequality in this country a frontline issue in the general election. Limiting the bonuses of a few thousand bankers at RBS may seem small beans on a global scale when we have so many problems to face. But we have to start somewhere, brothers and sisters. And if we succeed, if we are able to put down that clear marker that that kind of excessive capitalism is no longer supportable by a society that wants to have some form of equality, if we can put down that marker, then word of our victory will spread like wildfire, and people around the world will realise that the fight back has begun. Thank you very much for coming out today. Thank you.